When I said I wanted to go somewhere a bit cooler, Latimer, I didn't mean sub-zero.
I'd assumed that when you said a bit, it was just your usual penchant for understatement, Mum.
Is this the Arctic or the Antarctic?
The one without the ants, Mum.
What?
That's how to tell the difference, Mum. One is made of ants, the other is not.
Latimer, sometimes I worry that you're quite mad.
Is this another example of your gift for understatement, Mum?
No.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril.
Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't taken as long as us to discover the joy of RuPaul's Drag Race. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Whilst it is brutally cold outside, it's lovely and warm inside this heated tent. Actually, that word doesn't do this structure justice. I think small canvas palace is more appropriate, seeing as it has a carpet, sofas and ornaments, as well as heating. Make yourselves comfortable and we'll be cosy in no time.
I'm sorry to disturb you, but your guest has arrived, a Mr. Maurice Broadus.
Splendid! Let's see his calling card. Oh, a striking green stock. It says, Maurice Broadus, bon vivant. I do like that expression.
Ah, I just assumed he had a very long name and came from France.
Latimer, have you been at the sherry again?
I couldn't possibly comment, Mum.
Send him in.
Very good, Mum.
For those of you who don't know, Maurice Broadus has had short stories published in Lightspeed magazine, Weird Tales, Apex magazine, and Asimov's, to name but a few. He wrote the Knights of Breton Court trilogy and the novella, Buffalo Soldier.
Mr. Maurice Broadus, Mum.
Hello, Maurice. Do come and sit down. How are you?
Emma, thank you for having me. I am doing just fine. This is a lot better than I thought it was going to be.
Yes, it's a heated tent, thankfully.
Right.
It is a little bit chilly out there. I was complaining to Latimer. We recently had the most awful heat wave in the UK, and I can't stand the heat. So he kind of took it literally when I said that I wanted to go somewhere colder to take tea. Gotcha.
Well, I do like it a little cooler. I hadn't imagined this cool, but it's nice in here. Thank you.
Good. Would you care for some tea?
I would absolutely love some tea.
And how do you take it?
Cream and sugar.
Marvellous. And I was wondering if you would like a generous helping of Hunter's pudding.
Ooh, I'd love to try that.
It's perfect for winter. It's one of my favourite winter puddings. I think it was kind of invented in around the 1800s in the east of England. And it's a really dense sponge and like suet pudding with raisins.
Okay.
And it's nice and hot, which is perfect for the Arctic. And we'll have it with some custard. Do you like custard?
I do.
Oh, good. So there we go. This will warm you up. I hope you don't mind chickens. You're not allergic to chickens, are you?
I am not.
Marvellous. Well,
that has me concerned, but okay.
Well, just over there. They're very quiet at the moment.
Right.
Just over there in the corner, you can see a couple of chickens in the little pen over there.
Okay, perfect.
But they'll just stay over there. They won't bother us at all. And I'm glad that you're not allergic to them.
Yeah.
So in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
I have my grandfather's cane. It is a 3 feet long. It has a ball at one end with a leather strap through it, so that's the end that you hold it with. At the tip of it is a metal tip, and my grandfather, he used to have this during the, when he would, you know, get dressed up in the, like, the 1930s or so.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so this was the final piece to all of his outfits, and so when he passed, it got handed down to me, and I've always treasured it.
It's beautiful. I do love a nice cane to complete an outfit.
Right. Yep. So I come by it naturally.
And do you take it when you go out on the town, when you've got your very finest clothes on, do you go out there with your cane?
Absolutely. I have a cane and a bowler hat that I use to finish off my outfits.
I am utterly delighted. There is not enough of that happening in the world today. I'm so glad. It's lovely. It's lovely. And it's so beautiful, isn't it, having something that connects us to our grandparents, something physical that we can hold and remember them. It's lovely. Yeah,
absolutely. I love, that's always been a big thing in our family, is passing down little memories and stories so that we always have a memory of our past and a connection to our past.
Oh, I love that. I love that. So you recently guest edited an edition of Apex magazine. What was it like on the other side of the table, so to speak?
It was a nice reminder. Let's see. So I've done two anthologies for Apex, the Dark Faith series, and then I also edited an anthology called Streets of Shadows for Alliteration Inc. So I've done the editing thing before, but this is my first time running the magazine, and that was a different. It was a bit different for me because, you know, while I had the same amount of like slush that I had to read, and I think every writer, by the way, I think every writer should have to go through that slush pile at least once in their career just to see what it is they're up against and what it's like for them to move, what it's like for the editor side of things. And I know that after I did the first Dark Faith, my personal submissions improved a lot. When you see the kind of stories that come through, when you see how people don't listen to the submission guidelines, when you see some of the very common like story elements that you're like, wait, you see this all the time. Let me not do this anymore. You know, that sort of thing. And so, so I think every writer should spend some time in the slush pile. But just the idea of running every aspect of the magazine, from getting the stories to the essays and the poems and soliciting the art, I was just like, I can't believe people do this every month, because this I was good one time. I'm like, all right, yeah, I'm out. One time was more than enough for me.
So it's not something that you plan to do regularly, the magazine editing side of things.
Right, right. No, that's definitely not going to be a regular thing for me.
Well, that's really interesting. So in terms of the way that you're going to change what you do moving forwards, you said about avoiding those kind of story elements. Is there anything about like the query letter part of things and all of the kind of the administrative aspects that you will change moving forwards? Or is it mostly to do with what you're putting into the actual stories that's going to change?
Well, these days it's more about the actual stories, because luckily from pretty early on, I had the administrative side I had down pretty well, because and I always noticed that with how editors treated me, because if you just come across as a professional, they tend to treat you as a professional, and it's just if you don't avoid all the goofy stuff, people just they treat you like a professional right off the bat, no matter how many writing credits you have. So, yes. So they always appreciate that. And then, so for me, it's all about, you know, what kind of story, and I think it came down to learning what it meant to have, like, and this sounds weird, but a Maurice Broda story.
Right.
How does a Maurice Broda story stick out from everyone else? Like, I think ultimately that's what it boils down to, is how do you distinguish yourself from everyone else?
Oh, wow. That is actually, that seems to me a really hard question to answer.
Right. You know, so I think artists could spend a lifetime figuring that out.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when I'm thinking about it, I can't think off the top of my head how I would describe what I do. So do you have a much clearer sense of that now as a result?
I do. And I think part of what it is, you know, you get a sense of your voice just, you know, after you've just put in so many words, you know, after a while you start to get a feel for your voice. So I think the second phase of it is getting confident in your voice. Like, no, this is me. Let me just do my thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, I don't know how they do every... I don't know how people do, like, weekly or even daily publications. I could not take that amount of stress.
That was, like, the longest couple months. you know, And then I'm also not writing during that time either, because I'm just focused on, okay, I got to get this issue right, you know.
Yeah.
Basically, it's like, it is still my work, because it's like people are going to judge me based on the issue I put together. So I got to be all in on this.
Definitely. Well, I'm glad it was such a success, considering it sounds so difficult. I'm glad it was incredibly well received from what I saw online.
It has been. I've been very pleased with how people have looked at it.
was there a toy in your childhood that used to frighten you? I don't know why he wants to know this, but Latimer, my butler, would like to know this.
And I don't know why we had it in the house, honestly, but it was like this strange ceramic monkey.
Right.
And I don't know why. My mom always insisted on having these different like curios and trinkets around the house that we weren't allowed to touch. And one of them was like this strange ceramic monkey that she always kept it, that it was always in my room. And so it's like, I don't know why, but it was always in the corner of my room, you know, just sort of staring at me as I slept. And I'm like, why, mom? Why?
Oh my God, I can just imagine that it's the whole, when the lights go out and you know that it's still staring.
Well, the lights go out and there's just enough moonlight coming through the curtains and it just bounces off of the ceramic and so you just get the strange glow in your corner. Yes, all of that.
Oh, marvelous. So was there a toy that you always wanted and never had that you just happened to have bought for your own children?
Yes and no. I haven't bought it for my own children because it was, all right, so here's the thing. So, like, when I was young, there was this thing called, you know, everyone had big wheels, these little scooting, little, almost like a tricycle type thing that everyone had. But mm-hmm. for like, 1 year, there was this thing called the Green Machine.
Right.
And I always wanted a Green Machine. And it was, like, a really long version of a big wheel. But, like, only the really, really cool kids could afford the Green Machine. And I always wanted one of those. They don't make them anymore. Otherwise, my kids would be forced to ride around and say, Dad, why do I have to ride this? Because I could when I was your age.
You will have it and you will enjoy it. It's the reason I asked because I went to a party this weekend and we were laughing about various things that when you were a kid, it was such a big deal, wasn't it? That thing that you wanted that you could never have.
Right.
And that so many of the people at the party were like, yeah, I have that now. And I bought it for my son or I bought it for my daughter. We were like, oh, yeah, yeah, it was really for them. There are so many things we can enjoy now, aren't there? That,
right.
Yeah, for the kids.
for the kids, right.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, definitely. So the first time I had a proper conversation with you was way back in 2012 in Chicago during Worldcon over there. And you saved me at the tour party. It was my first room party. I didn't know anybody. And you will always have such a special place in my heart for being the person who saved me. And you also have like mini conventions at your house. And I was thinking about you at that party and how wonderful you were looking after me and that you have all these people who come to your house. And so my question is, do you have any advice for people who are socially anxious? Because you have so much social confidence. I was wondering if you have any advice that you could impart.
You know, that is so strange that you say that because I actually don't have a lot of social confidence.
Oh, wow. You could have fooled me.
Right, right. I always struggle with like anxiety issues and being around people. So you have that line between being an introvert and an extrovert. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm like right on that line. I'm still just on the introvert side, but I have just enough of the extrovert that, you know, I can fake it pretty well. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I come from a place where it's like when I look at what I want my life to be about and how I want to be remembered, I want to be remembered as someone who loved people well.
Oh, that's so lovely.
And so when I go to these situations, you know, it's like it's not that I put my fears aside, but it's like let me concentrate on my mission of knowing and loving people well. And so that's why I do. I focus on that aspect, you know, rather than I can't be around people. I focus on no. Let me try and love the people in front of me right now. And so that's how I try to go through things. But at the same time, I built, and this would be the advice part of things, would be I build in safety valves for myself.
Okay.
So like even when I'm having, you know, a bunch of people at my house or hosting major events, I have like, basically I call it my green room, basically, mm-hmm. where it's like a room where I can, or frankly, some of my guests, you know, sometimes you just need that space to be alone and be by yourself. Mm. So I have that room, that space sort of carved away for people to like, and now you can withdraw and just be away, recalibrate. Catch your breath, you know, and like I said, I have that even for me. So I have that space and again, you just need that space just to sort of catch your breath and go, you know what? It's not that bad. Let me just take a moment, gather myself. All right. Now I can go do this some more.
Yes. And that's so important during conventions, isn't it?
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's why, you know, at a convention, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of withdrawing back to your room. Like,
yes.
I'm at the party, let me sneak back to the room. No one should notice me. And then I can sneak back in, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the same for you, but on days where I've got really lots and lots of programming or it's been super social, sometimes I just have to go to my room and stare at the wall for a while.
Right, right.
And not emote and not do anything with my face. Just stare at the wall in a kind of, whoa, I just completely need to switch off for a few minutes
right,
now.
Right.
Yeah. I find that really reassuring that you don't think of yourself as socially confident, because I think there's always this kind of temptation to believe that everybody is more confident than you, isn't there? And learning that other people find it hard and yet are able to do the thing is so reassuring.
Yes.
Very much so.
When you realize how much smoke and mirrors are involved in life, then it makes you feel a little better.
Yeah, it does. And that, I think as I get older, I don't know if you find the same thing, but as I get older, I'm kind of realizing just how many of us are just kind of making it up as we go along. And I keep looking for the adult in the room and it's like, oh no, I'm supposed to be that adult now.
Oh no, it's me.
So does that mean that all of those times in my youth when I was looking to the adult in the room, they didn't have a clue either?
No clue.
No clue at all. We're just making it up. So you've been a published author for quite a lot of years now. And I was wondering if you could borrow our time machine and go back in time to give yourself advice before you were published. What would that advice be?
Ooh, that's a good question. Because, and see, I don't know how much advice I would give myself other than, you know what? Read even more. Read even more. The reason why is because, like, so early on in my career, I spent a lot of time just thinking through what would I like my career to look like. Mm-hmm. And so I spent probably a good couple years, you know, while I was writing, you know, before I was published, just literally studying the careers of writers and figuring out what did they do to get where they are.
Yes.
And so I'd mapped out a bit of a plan from early on. And I stuck to my plan. You know, I tweaked it along the way, you know, as I continued to bump into new people and learn. But I always stayed in learning mode. Mm-hmm. And I think that was probably the critical thing for me, is always be in learning. I'm still in learning mode, frankly. That actually helps, you know, when I bump into people, because, you know, when I bump into someone, it's like, hey, what can I learn from you? It doesn't matter where you are in your career. You're probably doing something I'm not. What can I learn from you? What is your story? And that helps me. And again, that's part of that, you know, learning how to connect with people, is that helps me connect with people. It's like, hey, you know what? You're someone I can learn from. What did you do that I could learn? Mm. So that always helped me. But yeah, I would probably read even more, because I always feel so underread, you know, no matter what genre I'm in. If I'm writing in horror, I feel like I'm, you know, way behind on some of the horror greats I've never had a chance to read. And in fantasy and science fiction, there's just so many great books out there. And I'm like, I don't think I started reading early enough.
I totally relate.
Right? I was like, my one thing would be, you know, go back in time. I'd probably go back all the way to probably even my high school years, where I was really just blowing off reading at the time. And I was like, this is 4 years. You could be reading even more rather than getting the cliff notes to these books and faking your way through assignments. Why don't you actually read these books? These will come in handy later. You know, I had to read Moby Dick in high school, but there's nothing worse than coming back and reading Moby Dick later in life. You're like, I should have had this done by now, you know.
Yes. It is quite scary as well when you go to conventions and you're on panels and everyone's talking about these amazing books and you think, I haven't read any of these.
Yeah, I feel like at some point someone's just going to come through and snatch away my nerd card. Like, yeah. Haven't read what?
Yeah, definitely. And then, like you said, it depending on the genre that you're in. And then if you write in a new genre and then you go to a panel about it and then everyone is like, well, where does your book fit into this? And right. You're like, I haven't actually read much. And you can't. Oh, it's the most excruciating moment. Yeah. So right. I would agree with that.
So here's the thing. Like, I just read, since it's just you and me here, I just read Lord of the Rings for the first time earlier this year.
Oh, fantastic. What did you think?
Here's the thing, is I had tried reading it probably 10 years ago. And I said 10 years ago, I was like, if I read one more elf song, I'm throwing this book away. Because these brothers break out into songs every other minute. And I'm just like, dang, I cannot do these elf songs. That's just not doing it for me. So I put the book down. And then like earlier this year, I was telling someone that story. And they're like, you do know most of us skip those songs, right?
Yes.
And I'm like, wait, we can do that? I thought that was something against the rule that, oh no, skip the elf songs. So then when I tried reading it this year, I was like, wow, I'm enjoying this book so much more.
Top tip, avoid the elf songs. Yeah, definitely. Oh, wow. Yeah, I think also there is a real thing about when in your life you meet a book and whether it's the right time in your life for that book. And,
absolutely.
You know, there is just some times in your life when it's not right.
Right.
You know, I'm not convinced that I would have enjoyed it as much now as I did when I was a teenager and read it. Yes. And I had like all of the time in the world to read it.
Yes. There are two authors who I felt that way. Like I only recently got to a place where I could really enjoy Toni Morrison's books. And so I've been reading some Toni Morrison over the last couple of years. But I still feel like I have to grow into, like, there's a book by Samuel Delaney called Dahlgren. And I'm like, next year I'll be the place where I can devour Dahlgren. But I feel like up until then, I feel like I'm doing all this literary exercising, you know, reading enough books to, okay, soon I'll be able to take on Dahlgren.
Yeah, like leveling up.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's a 20th level book. I'm not there yet. Yeah, I know the feeling, definitely. When I have a friend who comes to tea, mm-hmm. I like to ask people online if there's a question that they would like me to ask on their behalf. And the very lovely Cheryl Morgan, who I'm very, very fond of, would like to know more about your use of history in world building.
Yeah, I always consider history one of the great cheats of world building, which is ironic because like history and geography were my worst subjects in school. So life coming full circle, those are the two things that helped me most in my writing. And so my most recent novella, Buffalo Soldier, so that involves a Jamaican espionage agent. And how that whole thing came about was my mom has retired to Jamaica. And she went to a section in Jamaica, and she goes, oh, yeah, they only let outsiders in one time a year. And I'm like, what? She goes, oh, yeah, you know, way back when the British tried to colonize Jamaica, they couldn't conquer the Maroon people. So they left the Maroons alone. And basically, the Maroons had their own section of the island. They basically had their own separate government and all this kind of other stuff. And I'm like, how did I not know this? And so then I just became fascinated. Learning more about the Maroons, learning more about this history, learning more about the history of Jamaica. And then so all that then played into the world building when I set out to remake this steampunk version of Jamaica. I went with this alternate history involving the Maroon people. So yes, whenever I come to, whenever I sit down to write a story, I love the cheating off of history to in order to get there.
So is that always your favorite starting point? Do you start with real history and then kind of spin off from that? Or do you sometimes just kind of float about reading anything that is of interest and then being inspired? Is there a particular process in the use of history?
Yeah, it's more, okay, now I'm switching to the other. So I have a short story collection called The Voices of Martyrs. And it's divided into three sections, stories in the past, stories in the present, stories in the future. And it's always the stories in the past. I do a lot of period pieces. And with all the stories in the past, that's exactly where I start. I start with what is the real history? You know, what is, for example, what's the history of ancient Africa? You know, some of the kingdoms that were going on. Because that's my big thing is what are the stories that weren't told in history?
Mm.
So those are always the areas where I key in on. So what are these stories in ancient Africa? Let's see, there was a story set during the Civil War, and I'm like, all right, so what are some of the side stories during the Civil War that people never experienced? Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of thing. So I always start with history, but it's history of finding the stories that went untold. That's the area I tend to key in on.
And of course, with so much of history that we have such an impoverished view, having to view it through the victor's eyes.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Growing up in England and being British, I know this very painfully. And I wish that more people in my country knew just how horrific we have been, like, forever. Right. And it's so frustrating that there is, you know, just one kind of story that's told,
right,
whether it's like the Second World War or the Imperial era or mm-hmm. whatever. Yeah, I really like the sound of that. That's awesome. One of the things that I like to ask a friend who comes to tea can be seen as an unusual question, but the reason why will be revealed. So I always like to ask, what is the theme tune of your life? If you could pick one song, what would it be? And the reason I ask this is because of those chickens over in the corner that have been very quiet and well behaved up until this point. They're actually very talented musical chickens, and they have this extraordinary ability to sing a song if we ask them to sing one. So I'd like to ask you, what would be the theme tune to your life if you could pick one, and why?
If I could choose one, and I'll make it easier on the chickens, because there's a lot of hip-hop classics I could do that I could perform with the chickens, but one of them is Voodoo Child by Jimi Hendrix.
Excellent.
Why? It's, you know what, there's just something about Jimi Hendrix. He's in my top five favorite musicians of all time. I tend to gravitate to those people who you can never quite pin down in any one genre.
Mm.
You know, the Jimi Hendrix of the world, the Princes of the world. You know, those guys who you know, you can't quite pin down into any one genre. And Voodoo Child, that sort of sums up. Actually, that just sums up my life in a whole lot of ways.
Okay, so little chickens, please could you sing Voodoo Child by Jimi Hendrix for Maurice, please? And there they go.
Oh, that's kind of awesome.
They are very strange and incredibly talented chickens, but there you go.
There you go.
It's certainly a unique version of the song, I'm certain.
Right.
So you mentioned Buffalo Soldier and the Voices of Martyrs. Mm-hmm. Have you got any other jewels that your readers and fans can look forward to this year?
Well, this year I have mostly short stories coming out. Man, I've about a dozen short stories coming out over the next year. And then, but my next major project, which is just being announced, is my series of middle grade detective novels.
Ooh!
Yes.
Oh, wow!
So be looking for those very, very soon.
Oh, what's the name of the first one?
Right now it's called Special Ed, The Usual Suspects.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, I'm so excited because I have a son who is just the right age. So I am very, very excited by this news. That's wonderful. Is that your first foray into middle grade?
It actually is. In my real life, I guess you would say, I work a lot with kids.
Mm-hmm.
More as it seems, and so they're always like, hey, Mr. Broaddus, can we read one of your books? And I'm like, yeah, no. And I never thought that we'd get to this point, but, you know, I started writing stories so that they could see, yes, I am a writer, and I do write stuff that you can read. It's just, most of my stuff has been very adult. And so you know, we sort of pass these stories around, and then, you know, now they've been picked up, so.
Oh, that's so wonderful. I'm so delighted. That's great. Right, I'm just going to check the teapot. Oh, I'm afraid we're out of tea.
Yes.
So that's, I'm afraid all that means is that it's time for us to leave the beautiful freezing temperatures of the Arctic and venture back to the summer climes of our homes, which is a very sad thing. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and have tea with me today. It's been such a delight to catch up with you.
It's been so great. It's been too long, so we'll have to get together and do this again soon.
It has been too long. It has.
We'll definitely cross paths soon.
I'm sure we will. Well, you take care, and where's your coat? Oh, yes, it's over there. Latimer has your coat, because obviously we need to wrap up when we go outside of our lovely heated tent. Once you have your coat, if you follow Latimer, he'll show you across to the correct path to the bay so that we can get you sailed back home again. Do take care, and I will see you soon.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
This way, sir.
That was nice. Latimer, is it my imagination or is that funny patch of snow moving towards Maurice?
No, Mum. The snow is not moving.
Oh, good.
It's a polar bear.
Oh, no! But why is it following him? Do you think it likes Hunter's pudding?
Not as much as the fresh fish that I wrapped with it for Mr. Broadus to enjoy on his way to his death.
What?
Home. To enjoy on his way home.
Run, Maurice! Run! Oh, has he just run into a snowdrift?
Ah, he seems to have found my hidden shed.
You have a hidden shed in the Arctic?
Of course, Mum. Where else would I keep our festive seasonal decorations?
In the loft, like any other sane individual.
Ah, but we can't keep them in the loft because of the hairy... Actually, best you not know, Mum.
The polar bear is following the scent of fish towards the shed. I hope Maurice has locked the door.
I'm sure he has, Mum. But don't worry, I have the remote control right here.
No, it hasn't worked, Latimer. Look, the door's opening.
Oh dear, what a terrible, terrible shame.
Oh, he's coming out. What's that on his back?
It's a hastily improvised steampunk jetpack, made out of baubles, tinsel, and my emergency cutlery, the CAD.
Whoa, look at him go! I wonder what he used for fuel.
My sherry!
I knew it. Aw, the polar bear looks so sad to have lost his fish.
I understand the feeling. If you'll excuse me, Mum, I think I'll go and commiserate.
While Latimer is consoling the polar bear, I would like to raise my teacup to John Dexter and Carolyn Stein, the newest members of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order, go to www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy. And if any of you are going to Worldcon in Helsinki this year, we shall see you there. We're planning a live show of Tea and Jeopardy with a very special guest, who will be announced soon. Now, find us a tea there, would you, Latimer? Somewhere a bit warmer.
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.